Up next, so we've been talking about ATIP and BASS and the secret studies of UFOs and related issues. Long before ATIP, in between when Project Blue Book ended, there was another secret UFO study in the military. The guy who headed it up was Colonel John Alexander, Army Intelligence. He later worked with NIDS, and he was a commander of special forces teams in Vietnam and in Thailand and a lot of other interesting lines of work. He's an expert in the development of non-lethal weapons, and he has written extensively about UFOs and related phenomena. In a moment, we're going to talk to him about that other secret study, how it stacks up against current events. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Dr. John Alexander's most recent book is called Reality Denied, First-Hand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen. And it's a terrific read. It ties together a lot of the topics that we discuss, seemingly disparate and unrelated topics. But in fact, John has found a common link. We're going to get to that in a moment. But first, we're going to talk about a UFO study within the Pentagon that he headed up. John, great to have you back.
Good morning, George. Glad to be here.
Can we start with, I want to get your big picture take on recent developments, ATIP, New York Times, Nimitz, Tic Tac, a lot of press coverage, some congressional interest, a lot of public interest, new people coming to the subject matter. You've been around the subject for long enough to see other spikes in public interest and media interest. Is this one different?
I'd say it's a little early to tell yet. And as you say, I've been looking at it for decades. What is key is that they were able to get some support and funding where mine did not. But you're really reliant on getting institutional interest, people who are willing to go to the mat. Now, we are seeing some changes there. You did see the Navy just came out with a process whereby pilots can report these things. And I think that's a critical issue. Let's hope that that translates not just to the military, but in the civilian sector, particularly with airline pilots who are a little reluctant to report things as well.
Yeah, the Navy announcement was just out of left field. I mean, we know that there's a lot of things that have been going on behind the scenes and some new interest on Capitol Hill, so I guess it's not totally unexpected. But, you know, it seems unthinkable a couple of years ago for any branch of the service to openly talk about this and encourage pilots and other service members to come forward and report.
Yeah, that's true. And the media kind of, as you know, waxes and wanes on these things. And we'll see if it holds. One of the things that's new, of course, is there are more sensor systems out there, particularly in the civilian sector, that are, you know, capturing various phenomena as well. And I think that's important. What was of interest to me in the study between what Lou was able to do, basically the findings that we had were all the same. One difference, as I said, he was able to get some marginal funding where I was not, and we can talk about why not.
I think, well, let's go into that. What was your, tell us what your study was called, who was involved, and did you have to do this sort of under the radar and walk between the raindrops, or was it officially approved?
Well, it's kind of yes to all of the above. I put it together. We call it the Advanced Theoretical Physics program, and the reason was that FOIA, the Freedom of Information, had just come into vogue, and we were trying to avoid that and felt that people might ask about UFOs, but not necessarily about advanced theoretical physics.
ATP, ATIP.
And who was involved? We had participants from all of the services. Many of the intelligence community organizations and aerospace industry, they all had top secret SCI level clearances and all had to be interested and be willing to pay their own way. And we might mention there was not really any government funding that went into this at all.
So this was your brainchild, this idea?
Pretty much me, and there was another Air Force colonel who was interested, and it was literally an old boy net. They were all males and people that we knew had expressed interest in the topic.
And did you have meetings? Do you have files, case files, things of that sort?
Well, yes and no. We did have a number of meetings. And one of the rules was no written records, and that was particularly, again, to avoid the FOIA requests if they came in. That was violated, and a few people did apparently have files that I've now seen. Yeah, we had meetings, and interestingly, everybody thought that somebody else was involved. You know, it was kind of a, I thought you were doing this. And one of the things I point out is that there's a huge difference between individual interest and institutional interest or responsibility. And that is the area where Lou was able to get some institutional support. Conversely, as you know, he retired because he didn't think that support was sufficient.
That's pretty bold to do. I know you have expressed frustration to me that you were not able to get funding for it. Where would it be today? I mean, you must have theorized where it could have gone. You could have got a big jump on ATIP and other organizations.
Well, it was, and unfortunately, they did not pick up on, you know, I'm the only one that has all of the records on this. In the book, earlier book, UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities, I did lay out some of that. Now, we had the meetings, and I was briefing at very, very senior levels within Department of Defense and the intelligence community. And finally, we went to SDI, which, you remember, Star Wars, which at the time was probably the biggest program. It was about a $5 billion program, which was huge in the mid-80s. And we got to meet with the director. And it's interesting because I'll tell you, his eyes glazed over. It was obviously not a topic that he was familiar with. In fact, about I had introduced the briefing and started talking, and about 5 minutes later, it says, wait, who are you guys really? In fact, I had reps with me from the various agencies, and we went back around the table. By the time we were done, he says, you know, this is of interest to me, and I think this is a key issue. And he said, but I can't touch this. And the reason is, he says, I'm doing some hairy stuff. But if I get caught doing UFO research, you know, they're going to nail me. And they were after him because of the size of the budget. Congress was looking for a cut and did get $1 billion. But the point was that, you know, they felt that the risk associated had nothing to do with UFOs. It had to do with the perception.
Sure, that'd be an embarrassment.
Yes, and in his case, a very expensive one.
Well, I think that did in the OSAP program that was headquartered at Bass. If they find out what we're spending money studying, we're going to be embarrassed. It'll be on the front page of the New York Times. And, of course, some of it was.
Well, eventually. But as I understand what did happen, they tried to do it kind of keeping it hidden in plain sight. And understand that they said, well, we're going to do it. And then was it for advanced aerial threats? And other agencies came in and looked at, so we do advanced threats. I want the money. So we're able to get some of their funding.
You have made a point of, you know, while you had this operation going, you were trying to connect to other programs. You were actively looking for, hey, is somebody else studying this stuff? And you didn't find anyone. Secrets can be kept, right?
Yeah, our assumption going in, we had heard all the rumors and stories, was that somebody else was doing it. And we also thought that, well, we'll be at the right classification level, so if anything happens, somebody will come out and slap our hands. And I did get my wrist slapped a couple times, but not related to this program. So I know what happens when you hit a box, if you will, meaning a black program out there. Never happened, and I kept getting to higher and higher levels. I mean, we were at the top levels. Well, I had either director or deputy director of three-letter agencies that you think you know about, and you know, the secretary at in the Department of Defense, and in the Army, of course, because I was Army.
Earlier this year, I was able to break a news story about an amazing document, a letter written by Senator Harry Reid to the Department of Defense, I think the Undersecretary or Assistant Secretary of Defense, wanted to take the OSAP / ATIP program and make it a special access program in SAP. And one reason, Senator Reid had told me, one reason for that is they wanted to be able to interact with, I'm using air quotes, other programs that might have, in his words, materials that we'd like to see, stuff that we'd like to see. What are your thoughts on the existence of other programs studying different aspects of this mystery?
Well, hard to say. One of the things I have done is I've gone back and looked, and I took from Blue Book on, there are 962 authorized flag slots. That means colonels and generals. And my guess is that somewhere around 6,000 people have held those slots since Blue Book. So my question is not why do these programs pop up periodically, but why aren't there more? So I wouldn't be too surprised if there were something in there. Like I said, at the time I was operating, remember, we were talking three decades ago, certainly got, interest across the board. And I tried to get them pregnant. By that, I mean I would always ask for something and, get support. And that always happened. And I kept getting passed to higher and higher levels and asked for introductions and things of that nature, and it always happened. None of them came back and said, sit down, shut up, and, forget about this. And by the way, I have had that happen with other technologies.
One of your things that you and I have discussed before, again, I'm using air quotes around the Pentagon says, and I've used that statement myself, the Pentagon reports or the Pentagon states or the Pentagon policy. You have a bone to pick with people who use that kind of terminology. Explain it as it relates to this subject.
Well, what I say is the Pentagon doesn't say anything. It's a big stone building, and there's around 29,000 people that work in and around there. And the point is that they come in with a wide variety of personal experiences and interest in the area. And I keep going back to the difference between individual interest and institutional responsibility. One story that I have told you, I was talking to a three-star who was the head of one of those lettered agencies. And so when I got done, he says, well, I'll tell you about the ones I saw, but we don't have any institutional requirement. And this is one of those agencies that would absolutely have to be involved. So as a more junior officer, he had actually seen things flying around that he said, I know we don't have anything that does that.
You know, we began this program talking with Lou about the Nimitz, the Tic Tac incident. It's incredibly well documented. It happens over, right over this carrier group or in proximity to it. The pilots engage, get pretty close to it. There's video of it. The radar guys and witnesses have come forward to back up that testimony. And it ends up on the front page of the New York Times. It's sort of the centerpiece of this story about the existence of ATIP. And later that leads to BASS and OSAP. And that's an amazing case. But as we have learned since the story broke in the New York Times, and it is something that is explored in this new TV series that's coming out on the History Channel, a lot of the evidence disappeared. The logbooks and radar evidence, and, you know, people showed up on the ship in a helicopter, according to the witnesses. And I wondered if you have any thoughts on who are the mystery people that show up and take away records like that?
Don't know. And of course, this is much later. I do remember being in NORAD headquarters on a briefing and ask a question that says, you know, do you see things that, you know, zip about, make high right angle turns, et cetera, et cetera. And they go, oh, you mean UFOs? Yes. now, interestingly, what we learned is that even at the lower levels, they learn pretty quickly it is not career enhancing to report these. Mike mentioned that my last assignment was director of advanced system concepts, which was then the laboratory command. And my boss, the two-star, had been a ship commander on at NORAD. They had brigadiers. And again, when I talked to him, it was just, have no idea what you're talking about. And obviously in an agency where you would expect if those things were going up, it was, like I say, a very cool reception, and the guy was my immediate boss, so I had to be a bit careful there. But like I say, what we heard from people who were operators and a member of that North American Air Defense, and they were monitoring space. And remember, this is also the bad old days, i.e. we were worried about war with the Soviet Union. And everything we heard is you just don't pass that stuff up. You just kind of like, okay. It was seen rather routinely.
You know, I sent you the link, and I know you've read this story that popped up in the New York Times. Well, now it's yesterday. To have that in a paper of that stature is a big deal, at least in my world as a journalist, because of the reputation of the paper in journalism circles. It happened the last time, December 2017, when that story broke about ATIP. It made it okay for other media to cover it, and they did. Fox News seems to do something every month on UFOs. CNN did it. The Washington Post, other newspapers picked it up all over the world. And again, you know, the story that broke yesterday gives further details to these pilot encounters with really strange advanced technology that does not appear to be ours. I'm encouraged by that when the media environment changes in such a dramatic way. I mean, it's before 2017, it had been a long time since the New York Times had written about UFOs in a positive light. Going forward, do you see that as a positive development and something that could last?
Well, what we know is that neither of those were accidental. We have mutual friends who were integrally involved in getting it. Chris Mellum, obviously, is one of the key guys. But some of the folks with To the Stars and Lou, of course, has the program that's coming out that you've mentioned several times. These folks are working diligently behind the scene, basically putting their credibility on the line, and have been able to go to, say, the New York Times. They did not take that lightly. I mean, it took the first article in December 17 a lot of hard testimony and
vetting, yeah,
proving to them. Yeah, they didn't say, oh, that's weird, I think we'll publish it.
You're right. It took a lot of work, and the same was true for this story. We're talking with Dr. John Alexander. His latest book is Reality Denied. Marshall Tucker takes us into the break. Colonel John Alexander is my guest in this hour, and Dr. John Alexander, former Colonel John Alexander. As we began the discussion with Lou Elizondo in the first hour tonight, we're talking about nuts and bolts craft seen in the sky, flying saucers. Jacques Vallée took us to a different place, examining psychic, supernatural, spiritual aspects of these mysteries and how they relate to things that are seen in the sky. John Alexander is the guy who can sort of link all of that together. His most recent book, Reality Denied, examines the common ground between those kinds of phenomena and a much broader aspect that we haven't yet to discuss. We're going to get into that in the next segment. Try to save a couple of minutes for calls and questions and comments from you as well. We'll be right back. John, as you probably know, over the years, I've yammered a few times on this program about the search for the elusive unified theory of weirdness, and you're just the guy to deliver it. As I mentioned, you know, there's flying saucers, structured craft that Lou Elizondo, ATIP, OSAP were pursuing. There's a strange spiritual, supernatural, ethereal phenomena that Jacques has been pursuing. There are an array of related reports from around the world. You've been chasing all of them for a long time and document a lot of it in Reality Denied. Give me the broad strokes.
Yeah, well, it's let me just start with UFOs. And what I do in the lecture is, hey, well, what do you mean? And specifically, I've got little balls of light that wander around. I've got huge craft that miles, sometimes multiple miles across, and thousands and thousands of variations in between. So the issue is, what are you talking about? And we do see, and I think as Jacques talks about, a consciousness component to it. One of the things I'd like to follow up on, I was listening to the interview, and you were talking about South America in particular. And I just came back in April from being in Brazil on a weapons conference. But I think there's a significant difference there, and it underlies quite a bit of why there's a difference in understanding. And part of it really gets to our educational system, which is based on a materialistic view of science. You know, we split things into smaller and smaller parts. We'll get to the God particle, et cetera. Whereas, although the Brazilians I deal with, and these are very, very high-level folks, well-educated, and in institutions that basically follow, you know, the Western paradigms, if you will, but they also incorporate a spiritualism, and they have a spiritist history and can integrate these things in ways that are just very different from what we tend to do in the North and in Europe.
It's hard to convey this on radio. I've tried to do it on television with taking a camera into your house, and your house is the equivalent of like Disneyland's It's a Small World, because you got pictures and ornaments and collectibles from all over the planet. You travel a lot, and many of the people you go to see are shamans. You interact with them. Your wife interacts with them. It's a learning curve to see how they interact with the unknown world. How does that relate to UFOs?
Well, I think, again, you get back to the consciousness part. One of the things you mentioned with Jacques, you're talking about a film that I have not seen. But it reminded me of a case I was involved in. It was actually my second UFO sighting. That's with Chris Bledsoe. And the reason I bring it up is it had so many components to it. Obviously, they see lots of UFOs. They have interactions with various kinds of creatures. You have spontaneous healing that took place. What got my attention specifically, I was visiting him, and we were sitting in the field, and he was describing where certain things happened, and all of a sudden he says, oh, I think they're here. And within just a few seconds, this thing pops into view above us and goes zipping off early evening. It did not fly in. It just materialized and zipped off.
And this is ongoing.
And they have, you know, he talks about orbs and thinks that there's communications that take place. They do healings with other people. And so you have so many different phenomena wrapped into that case. And again, we've got having had the personal experience is the thing that, as I said, got my attention.
So what the heck is that?
I don't know. Again, I argue, and I think Jacques and I are actually very close, philosophically on these issues, and that is that human consciousness is, in fact, a piece. When you look at UFOs historically, we know that, say, in the 1800s, you had airships that were floating in the sky and, you know, coming down. And what you tend to see are things that are technologically advanced, but it's not 1,000 years in advance. It's, you know, a short time above the technology as it exists at that particular time, but not beyond our comprehension or ability to project what might occur.
It's just a little bit tantalizingly out of our reach.
Constantly. And as you know, you mentioned the ranch, and yes, I was with Bob the day he bought it, and I was the first one to spend the night up there of the NITS people. And that place is phenomenal. And the problem is that, as you know, we tried to instrument it, and every time things would happen, and you start to say, oh, I'm going to study it, and here's how I'd go about it. And as you know, I've had come up with a precognitive sentient phenomena of fame. That means that there is something, an it, that is running the show, and it is definitely in charge. And every time you get something and you say, oh, I'm going to study it, and they go, oh, you like that? Try this. And the phenomena would morph again, and constantly ahead of us.
Jacques wrote in his book, of course, he mentions you as being a key participant in the NIDS efforts to figure out not only the ranch, but a broader spectrum of phenomena. And were you in on some of the debates that the Science Advisory Board had about how to approach the ranch?
Oh, yes.
Technological or spiritual?
Yeah, no, for many of the people, as he mentions in the book, I was able to bring some scientists that generally would not have been related. I used Dean Judd as an example, a friend of mine from Los Alamos, which was my second career. But he had also been the technical director for the SDI program he mentioned earlier, and he'd also been the national intelligence officer for science and technology. That's where everything, you know, comes together in the intelligence community. You just would not have had folks like that. Again, very interested in the topic and brought a very pragmatic approach, but were willing to explore things. And Dean is one I mentioned. I included him in the book because, unfortunately, he died just by... and like a lot, many of the people, they say, you know, yeah, I'm interested, but let's not go public with this. Again, you know, worried about reputation.
I want to come back to NIDS in a moment. Take a call on the wildcard line. Paul in Boston has a question for you, John. Hi, Paul.
Boy, what an outstanding program! Unbelievable. My question is this. Has any of the military pilots ever tried to engage any of these in the form of combat? When the wall fell in East Germany, the KGB let go some of their records. They indicated that the Russians had shot down several, and they had one of their bases decimated because they had shot them down. They had returned injuries. So I'm wondering if any of our pilots ever had tried to involve them in combat.
John, do you know of any cases where U.S. pilots tried to shoot them?
Yeah, there are a series of these. A U.S. pilot, Milt,
Prell?
The case over the U.K., huh?
Yeah. I think his name was Prell, maybe, or no? No, that's not it.
But anyway, this is the old days. F-86 is vectored into a huge craft that is showing up on radar, size of an aircraft carrier and all that. And he described going in and said he decides to pickle. He's going to shoot off all his rockets. And this thing that has been hovering there as I said, in two turns of the radar, it was off the screen, meaning 250 miles in 2 seconds. There are some other cases, not U.S. is a famous one over Tehran, in which they were using American systems, but it was Iranian pilots. These are the day of the Shah, and they interacted with something. And it was very interesting because long and complex case, but as the guy goes in, he says, I was getting ready. He was going to fire AIM-9 missiles. And when he did, his weapons panel shot down and communication was shut off. He banked and came out, and it came back up again. Where that's of interest to me is I used to run the tactical directed energy programs for the Army, and I know how, using things like microwaves, I can shut you off. Don't know how to turn you back on again. There's a similar case over Peru where a UFO, again, a Peruvian pilot, ends up using, I believe it was 30-millimeter shells and firing it into a UFO, and it sort of went, you know, like it was absorbing them or something and had no adverse effect on it. So the notion of shooting them down, I have some problems with that.
I can tell you, Paul, what happened in Russia, because I was able to obtain some documents from their Ministry of Defense, formerly classified, some still classified, and an interview with the Ministry of Defense official, a colonel who was in charge of their UFO study. He said there were 40 instances where Russian warplanes engaged UFOs. In three of those cases, the Russian planes crashed, and in two of those three cases, the pilots died. And after that, they issued a general order just to say, leave them alone, because in the words of one Russian general, they might have incredible capacities for retaliation. So that seems like a good idea. Thanks for the call. John, back to NIDS. Of course, as Jacques writes in his book and as you write in your book, Reality Denied, that was an amazing group of people put together for the purpose of trying to figure this stuff out. And Bob Bigelow spent a lot of money on it and gets nothing but grief. You were there. You were part of it. The words that are used to describe Bob and NIDS, shadowy, suspicious, you know, it's a CIA front. Bob's trying to capture the technology so he can keep it to himself. Your response to that?
Well, the problem, of course, is secrecy in general. And the problem there is that people make up stories when they don't have full access to it. As we know, we're now living in the post-truth era, which is far bigger than any of the phenomena we're talking about now. But as I say, as you know, and again, the briefings, the three things you need if you're going to participate, one is thick skin because you're going to get attacked. The other is understand conspiracy theory because you're part of it, because either you believe there's a cover-up or if you don't, you're part of it. And you keep hearing these things. Let me expand this just a bit more and suggest that I don't see UFOs per se as a government issue. I think it's far bigger than that. I think we're looking at something that's at least as complex as cancer. I question if people want the government involved. What they do bring to the table are obviously some very advanced sensors, some brain power, but they also bring the propensity to classify stuff. And with the sensor systems that are now available in the public sector, you know, I think you've heard me say, I think we need something like the human genome program on steroids. And that's one where you have massive integration, many countries involved, educational institutions, research that share data. And the problem with all of these phenomena is a propensity to not share.
Yeah.
And thus, when you're dealing with complex issues, very difficult to get resolution.
Well, I mean, there is a very real question mark about the technology. If we can master it or some of it, it would give us an incredible advantage over real world adversaries. There's no getting around it.
When you get back to the advanced theoretical physics, I mean, I used that argument, okay? That was one of my first slides, and I was trying to convince people, why would you do this? And part of it was, A, leapfrogging, that we'd have a big leap, and the other was that, again, bad old days, Soviet Union, a breakthrough by them would have been unacceptable.
That's a lot of what Senator Reid said, that the reasoning went into the creation of the ATIP program or OSAP program. We got to worry about other adversaries getting this technology before we do. And he had said, he didn't spell it out exactly, but has said that he had indications that the Chinese and Russians were both trying it, and the Chinese, he thought, were a little bit ahead. That's kind of scary.
You correctly, in the earlier segments, pointed out this is a global phenomenon. It's not just here, and everybody talks about E.T. coming and landing on the White House lawn, and you go, wait, we're 4% of the population of the world, of, you know, tiny percent of the overall area of the world. So if somebody's coming across the universe a gazillion miles and that, why do you think they're going to end up at the White House?
And if they did, would we be able to communicate with them? It's an issue that you have tackled in an interesting way in Reality Denied. It's communications between species, because, you know, we think we're going to be able to talk to aliens, or hope we will someday. May be a good idea to try to practice on other species that are already here. And there have been some breakthroughs in interspecies communication.
Yeah, well, there's a whole chapter in there, what we did with working with dolphins, and I've also been with whales in the open ocean. And that was interesting because you're talking something that runs 35, 40 tons and coming within inches of us and knowing exactly where we were. And, you know, with a flip, you know, the flippers are, in that case, as big as I am.
We're almost out of time. I'm sorry, John. I shouldn't have started that one with so little time left. I would recommend that people check that out, because if you want to communicate with an alien, maybe you should start with other animals that we have here on planet Earth before you do. John Alexander, thanks very much for joining us. Reality Denied is the name of the book, and we appreciate you being here. Earlier, Dr. Jacques Vallée, and of course, Lou Elizondo from TTSA. I want to thank my colleagues there at Coast, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, Dan Galani, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. Good night, everyone. I'll be back in a couple of weeks.